Hi, we're Josh
and Arielle Wamsley,
owners of Green Valley Tree LLC, based in North Windham.
We're proud to sponsor Connecticut East this week and to serve the communities of Windham and New London counties with our tree removal and plant healthcare services.
Visit our website at greenvalleytreeworks.com for a full list of our services or give us a call on 860-234-4041. We look forward to hearing from you.
Tracking Connecticut's opioid problem, UConn's SWORD project shows success in its first year. And Mitchell College in New London gets a new president as we talk to Dr. Tracy Espy. Plus a look at other stories making the headlines from around the region. This is Connecticut East This Week. Hello, I'm Brian Scott Smith. The opioid epidemic in this country is a battle that is ongoing, and with COVID-19 added to the mix, the situation has become even more important. Connecticut has its opioid problems, and a year ago a new tracking initiative was developed for the state by UConn Health. The idea was to help EMS and other healthcare providers by supplying new real-time data about opioid issues across the state to help identify hotspots and flare-ups, as well as giving the state data to allow them to deploy resources where they needed them most. I caught up recently with Peter Canning, an EMS coordinator for UConn's John Dempsey Hospital and one of the creators of the tracking initiative. Ever so many thanks for joining us, Peter.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Brian.
A new report out about Connecticut's statewide opioid reporting directive, or SWORD as it's known. Tell us UConn's involvement in this.
Well, so yeah, UConn Health, we recognize that the opioid overdose epidemic is, you know, maybe the number one health, public health problem in Connecticut today. So we've been involved on a lot of fronts. Let's see, maybe 2 years ago, we decided to try to track some of the EMS data. Now, Governor Malloy had an opioid task force, and they came up with a number of different recommendations. And two of the major recommendations were to better track the use of naloxone and to find ways to share information better. So taking that as an impetus, what we decided to do is in the city of Hartford, we worked together with American Medical Response Ambulance and St. Francis Hospital. And what we did is we created a pilot program where when ambulance crews responded to an overdose, they would call the poison control center, report the overdose, and answer a series of 10 questions. That information would be put into software at the poison control center and analyzed. So we did that for about 9 months. We issued reports every month. We were looking at the ages of people overdosing, what they were overdosing on, you know, were they going to the hospital, were they staying in the hospital, whether or not, what type of paraphernalia was at the scene. And the program was so successful that the state health department decided to make it a statewide directive. So starting in June of 2019, all EMS organizations in the state are now required to call poison control after opioid overdoses.
And just to be clear, poison control is actually part of UConn, correct?
Yes, it is. So the poison control center is staffed 24 hours a day with specialists who are either doctors or nurses who answer the calls. And when EMS calls, what they do, in addition to taking the information from EMS, is that they call the hospital that the patient was brought to, and they track the progress of the patient in the hospital so they can find out how, you know, what the lab results were on the patient, whether the patient died in the hospital, whether they were, that, you know, sent home, whether they were in the ICU. So it's a very thorough look at it's what happens to the overdoses in Connecticut.
So Peter, tell us, what are some of the key benefits of the SWORD program, you know, for the state? I understand from reading the press release, there's near real-time intelligence and information that is being gathered, which clearly is always a great thing. But what are some of the other key benefits that the SWORD program has brought?
So before you do anything, it's really important that you have current and correct data. It's essential to understanding the opioid crisis and its future direction. It also gives us the ability to allocate our resources most effectively. Now, what we've done, in addition to just calling the overdoses in the Poison Control Center, the locations of the overdoses are mapped in a federal software called ODMAP. So we're able to look at the state and see where the hot spots are. We took that information, and for 16 of the cities, we created heat maps. So that if you are a harm reductionist or work for the public health department in one of those cities, you now have a map of where most of the overdoses are occurring. So you can direct your resources there. We also were able to tell what time of day overdoses are most likely to occur, what days of the week. So that's very important for targeting resources. Just looking also at the ages, I mean, a lot of people think that the overdose epidemic is largely young people, but there's quite a number of people in their 50s and 60s who suffer from addiction and are dying out there. I know I was at one meeting once where people were saying we need to put Narcan, which is the opioid antidote, into our middle schools. But we're able to say that middle schools and even the high schools are not where people are overdosing on opioids. So largely an older demographic than you would expect.
And these heat maps that you were talking about, Peter, I mean, clearly they're very important. I mean, one of the things that could they do, are they able to give you an idea of the types of drugs as well that are being used in areas, you know, whether it's heroin or fentanyl?
Yes. So what we do is every time that somebody comes in, we ask what the opioid was. Now, unfortunately, in a lot of cases, you might respond to an overdose. The person's not breathing, you give them naloxone, they respond, and they deny that they use drugs at all. And if there's no paraphernalia there, we can't tell what it is. But in many cases, they do tell us what they used. So we found that in Connecticut, when the opioid was known, it was pretty much always heroin or fentanyl. 87% of the time, people were overdosing on heroin or fentanyl, as opposed to prescription opioids or methadone or Suboxone.
I take it as well that having this type of data, I mean, clearly data is so critical for so many things, being able to view and crunch this data. The opioid epidemic, you said a little bit earlier, you know, people would be surprised about ages. I'm guessing it's constantly changing as well, especially with things like COVID around.
The COVID has been interesting to try to determine how much it's been affected. What we're seeing is a lot more people are of the fatalities go up when people use alone. In April, we had a big spike in the number of overdose deaths, and I think that could be contributable to COVID. At the same time, in other ways, the COVID has helped in that, for instance, people who are on the drug methadone, which is an opioid drug that is much less stronger than heroin or fentanyl, and it allows people to fight off their urges, and that they can maintain jobs, they can, you know, have families, and they can live, you know, decent lives. But in most cases, if you're on methadone, you have to go to the methadone clinic every morning, which is very difficult for people. With the COVID epidemic, what happened is many more of these people were given a whole supply a week or 2 weeks or longer so that they could use it at home, which is an easier thing for them.
You're an EMS. You've been an EMS for a very long time. You know, clearly you saw the value in helping to create this project. But what changes are you seeing over time, just generally when it comes to the use of drugs and how it's affecting, you know, people in the state of Connecticut?
So, Brian, I've been a paramedic for over 25 years. And when I started, there were heroin overdoses, not to the degree that they are now. When I started, I thought, like many people do, that people who use heroin, they have a character flaw. And I would say to them, you know, just stop using drugs. You got to say no, otherwise you're going to end up dead or in jail. But as the years went by and the number of overdoses started increasing and I started talking to my patients more, I began to learn that addiction is not a character flaw, that it's a horrible brain disease. And that most of the people that I resuscitated would say to me, I used to be a normal person once. And what happened to them is they got hurt or they got sick. They got given high doses of prescription drugs and then they were cut off. And by then their bodies had, you know, had adapted to the drug and they were horribly addicted. And I began to see that, you know, any one of us could have, you know, been sent down this path. And that really what we need to do, rather than stigmatizing these people, is to treat them as we would treat anybody else of, you know, with a heart disease or lung disease, treat them as family members, as people who deserving of love and compassion. And so as the number of overdoses increased over the years, I became more and more aware and I studied more and talked to people more. And now rather than saying, just say no, you know, I will teach people if they're going to use, how to use safely. Or if they're in a place where they're ready for help, I can direct them to resources that can help them. But the main thing is that dead people don't make good decisions. And we really have to look out for these people and do the best we can to try to keep them alive until they're ready to get help.
Are we winning the war against opioid and substance misuse?
No, I don't think that we are. I think the war on drugs has been a colossal failure. I think that the key to getting a handle on this is through something called harm reduction, which is needle exchange, community naloxone, which we've been doing and has certainly helped, safe injection sites, and, you know, continued amounts of outreach. You know, I think that there's a lot of people doing a lot of good work out there, but the death numbers continue to rise, and it's really something that demands as much attention as we can give it.
I suppose the one positive that we can pull out of this, though, at the end of the day is a system like SWORD at least does give all of you on the front line a fighting chance to understand, as you say, where those hotspots are and what is trending in the world of drugs, even if it is, you know, an uphill task for everybody. At least there's some credible data there.
Yes, and what we have had a number of cases is by the quick reporting of EMS, we've been able to identify times when there's a contaminated batch of, say, crack cocaine out there that's been contaminated with fentanyl. So we can get out on the streets and warn people who use crack cocaine to not use alone, to have naloxone there. If there's a particularly strong batch of heroin out there and we see a spike in overdoses, we can get people out in the streets and get the word out and try to, you know, get a lot of naloxone out and have recovery coaches available. So it's a long battle and it's not close to being won.
Well, Peter Canning, EMS coordinator for Yukon John Dempsey Hospital, it's been a privilege and a pleasure talking to you, sir. And all I can say is we're grateful to have people like you out there and the rest of the first responders, obviously helping to keep society as safe as possible. And certainly SWORD, obviously, is helping you to do that. So thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks again for having me, Brian.
Higher education in this country is struggling and has seen decreased student enrollment for the last 8 consecutive years. And Mitchell College, a liberal arts college in New London, is not immune to what is happening to higher education either. That said, they recently brought in a new president, Dr. Tracy Espy, to help turn around the college's fortunes and set it up for success in these challenging times. Connecticut East this week sat down with Dr. Espy to find out what her plans are and why she took on this challenging role.
President Espy, ever so many thanks, obviously, for the interview. And, of course, welcome to Connecticut and also to Mitchell College.
Thank you.
Was it a fairly quick job application for you? Because these things are very important.
In general, presidential searches in higher education tend to be several months. So I would say it started probably sometime in January and ended in April.
And what made you want to come here? I mean, you were a provost and a former vice president down at Pfeiffer University in the lovely state of North Carolina. So why move from North Carolina to the cold Northeast?
It's not cold here yet, Brian.
So trust me, it will be.
I know. Well, keep in mind, if you did your homework, I lived in Syracuse, New York, which is snowmageddon to those of us who have lived there and worked there and schooled there. So for me, moving to Connecticut was only about Mitchell College, right? So when I learned about Mitchell College's mission and how it works with students of all learning abilities. It didn't matter where it was located. That's something that's very important to me, and so I was very interested in the college's mission and the ways in which it chooses to educate students of all learning abilities. And so that's really the chief reason that I've moved here. But I must add, I thoroughly enjoy the shoreline. So that's an added bonus, I believe.
I believe there's something here called the Mitchell Ability Model, which was also something that you were interested and obviously grabbed your attention. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? Because I understand that is something that you want to add to and maybe hope to possibly even export.
Exactly. The Mitchell Ability Model really is about learning from a, I like to think about it as a really innovative way of thinking about liberal arts education, right? You know, the practicality of it. And it really is about the student's journey. It's over 4 years or two, depending when you come. It has to deal with exposing students to things like, you know, building their career interests, to, you know, resume writing, learning to focus on transferable skills, helping them to determine, like, what particular area that they're interested in studying, and then also continuing to build on that and developing skills. So it's about skill setting. It's really about looking at areas and competencies such as critical thinking, excellent writing ability, public speaking, being creative. So it's a range of different abilities that prepare students to be able to adapt no matter what career situation happens. So if you think about it, there's a lot of data that points to the fact that most of the jobs that students will be working in the future have not even been developed. So what the Mitchell Ability Model does is that it builds upon those transferable skills that allows a student to be able to adapt to whatever the future is asking them to adapt to in terms of a career or job.
You are only the second woman president of Mitchell College, is that correct?
Actually, there's been three. There was Dr. Jakowski, who's currently the president of Three Rivers, and then there was Janet Steinmeier, who's currently the president of Lesley University, and then there's me, the eighth president. So it's been three.
Do you feel that a female president brings a different perspective to, you know, not just your own educational background and your background generally, but do you think that women bring a different perspective to these types of jobs than men or not?
Well, it's hard to know because I've only been a woman, and I can only speak sort of and think from sort of my being. But I'm not sure if it matters in terms of a male or female. I haven't looked at the data on that or the research. I think that it's about people that are compassionate and caring, that have a focus on educating all kinds of students, that believe in the power of education to transform lives and minds. So I think regardless of whether you are male or female, having sort of these qualities that are built on or focused on really educating the young person and seeing their lives be transformed by education, I think that gender is not necessarily best one or the other. It's just having that sort of core belief and commitment to young people in higher education, or a commitment to all people in higher education.
You are the first African-American president of this college. Mm-hmm. We often see in the media so many stories about barriers to education for people of color. Do you think that having somebody like yourself therefore helps to boost the people out there? You can do it. There's no reason for you not to do it. Do you think that helps?
Brian, I sure hope it does. I mean, I think about the people that have been in my life, the mentors, the support systems, the advocates that I've had. They certainly seeing somebody like yourself, whether it's a female, a person of color, or whatever, fill in the blank, to see someone do something that you may want to do, you can begin to believe that it's possible. So yeah, I hope that it inspires people that they can do anything that they want to do if they put their mind to it. So to me, hopefully it will help a lot of people. And even people not just going to college, but to think about their pathways to them being a leader in whatever capacity that is.
I just want to ask you a quick question, obviously, about your own growing up. I mean, is this the type of field, the area, the career that you wanted to go in? I mean, education is an incredible thing to get into. Was it something that you were leaning towards when you were younger?
I don't think that I would have imagined sitting on my front porch in Alabama that I would be a college president. It just wasn't there. I mean, I thought that I might be a doctor of some kind, and I think it was only really in graduate school where I was really involved at Syracuse in administration, and then ended up working at Syracuse and very involved in the dean's office, that I began to see what could be done from the administrative side of the house to really help students persist and graduate, or to help students sort of change their life academically if they were struggling. And that was really the beginning formations of, I think I probably want to do something in administration in higher education. I knew I wanted teaching, research, and administration. I just didn't know how it would look. So I think for me, it wasn't in my earlier years. It was certainly in my years postgraduate. I think that I began to, in graduate, but then really postgraduate, began to think about how might I be able to make a difference in the lives of students through administration. That's how I got here.
I want to turn to the fact that last year in 2019, Forbes magazine do their yearly sort of grading for financial soundness for colleges. Mitchell College didn't get a very good grade last year. In fact, it got a D. Does that concern you at all? Because we've seen, and their report also shows, that higher education, and I think we can both agree on this, it is a challenging environment. The amount of people enrolling is down, and that's been a trend for a while. And many private colleges have either closed or merged, even up here in the Northeast. So what challenges and concerns do you have about that?
Clearly, a D is not a great grade, but what a D can do is to motivate you to get to the next level. I think that being someone that's new to Mitchell and really at this point in my 14th week here starting, yay me, yay Mitchell, yay all of us. But I think I'm really looking at, like, how did we get here, which doesn't really matter that much, but it's understanding kind of where the institution's financial position was a few years ago. And typically with the different surveys, it's over a number of different criteria. You know, whether you're looking at U.S. News World Reports, you've got Forbes, you've got several. So for me, the biggest concern is, what has Mitchell done to this point? And I can tell you that a couple of years ago, Mitchell brought in someone that really understood finances and created an incredible financial model for the institution that really points the institution towards budgeting for things like deferred maintenance, budgeting for sort of this, I wouldn't say it's conservative, but this sort of growth of enrollment, growth of auxiliary services, and looking at that from a financial model that sort of spread out over a number of years. So having that in hand as a base for a new president certainly helps and gives me a lot of confidence. And Mitchell's done very well. I mean, they've sort of turned themselves around from maybe where they may have been several years ago to balancing budgets, to actually having a pretty decent ratio on the Department of Education financial ratio. So it typically looks at colleges from anywhere between 1.0 to 2.0 or 3.0 being, if you're on the side of the 1.5 and below, not as great, but then above that, you typically are considered financially responsible. And Mitchell's been in that financially responsible category for quite some years. I think where we are right now is continually to, you know, build and strengthen our enrollment profile. I mean, you said it well, that colleges have fewer students that are available to come to college. And of those students available, not all of them will want to come to college. So our strategy is, where do we fit within the landscape of higher education? And I do think with our Mitchell Ability Model and the fact that we focus on students of all learning abilities, that we do have a great niche, you know, in the market to continue building. So I feel pretty confident about where we are today, and not only where we are today, but where we can go in the future. I think we have some really great, we've really laid some good groundwork to sort of build forward from. And we'll continue to do that. I mean, my thing about being in higher education is that you have to be flexible and you have to be able to pivot at any given point in time. And I think we would both agree sitting here today that COVID's got us all thinking about, I might need to have a pivot plan somewhere, no matter what career I'm in.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. And then COVID came along. But I mean, you come from a college that embraced sort of online studying many, many years ago. In fact, you were probably one of the leaders down in North Carolina, I would suspect. So you come with a really good pedigree and a good knowledge and background about how to do it.
True. I think my previous institution probably started doing online before I even realized that's what we were doing. But I think what we see now is that we have to be able to do both and. So whether it looks like straight, meaning direct online, everything remote, or more of a hybrid model. But I do see that the use of digital transformation in higher education is key. And there's so many ways that that can look, right? So we typically think about digital transformation as just being we're fully remote and we're having both synchronous and asynchronous learning with students. But I see the advancement in technologies as so much more. I mean, there's applications to being able to connect to people with education. It's just a lot. I'm excited in a lot of ways because the, I don't know what to call it, but the excitement sort of the post-COVID-19 higher education revolution is sort of appealing because I'm so new as a president. I got nowhere else to go but innovation. And that's what excites me.
Yeah, I was going to say, because education aside, even the working and business world is going to be completely different. And obviously, being able to deal with that new world of working comes from being educated into how to do it.
That's a great point. It's really interesting. There was some data that just recently came out about the fact that most businesses or most jobs in the future will have some component of technology. And that's something to think about and reflect upon. Now, even if we think about healthcare, which is one of the fastest growing enrollment segments in society, and it's been that way for a number of years, if you look at the United States Department of Labor projections for employment and employable careers, it's sort of at the top. And even if you think about just if you went to, say, a doctor's visit, the ways in which technology is integrated into that. So I think being able to find an innovative way that's slightly disruptive, but disruptive in a great way to enhance the curriculum is a good thing. So I'm really looking forward to having those conversations with our faculty, our staff, and even our students about what it can look like and be, not just today, but in the future. So I'm excited about that.
Dr. Tracy Espy, president of Mitchell College, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for the interview.
The pleasure's all ours. Thank you so much.
Green Valley Tree LLC is proud to sponsor Connecticut East This Week. Contact Green Valley Tree LLC for all your tree removal and plant health care needs and more. Find us at greenvalleytreeworks.com or call 860-234-4041.
Time now for a look at some of the other stories making the headlines in the region recently. In the Connecticut Examiner, added nursing staff can save lives, report shows, but costs remain a hurdle. According to Mathematica's final report published recently, the lower the ratio of staff hours to residents, the more cases and deaths of COVID-19 in a nursing home. The current state requirement is that nursing homes provide 1.9 staff hours every day for each resident, less than half the 4.1 staff hours currently recommended by the National Institute of Health. In the day this week and in New London, the City School District reported another case of COVID-19. A district employee at Nathan Hale Arts Magnet School, whose illness has forced closure of one class at the school. The students in the one classroom will be shifted into full distance learning for 2 weeks as a precautionary measure, Superintendent Cynthia Ritchie said in a notice to the elementary school families. In the Norwich Bulletin, Connecticut's new reopening phase is getting a tepid reception. A number of restaurant owners say they won't be able to reach the new 75% capacity limit for indoor dining because they don't have the space, primarily due to the requirement that tables be at least 6 feet apart. The indoor capacity maximum is being increased from 50% as of October 8th. Governor Lamont has signed legislation that increases accountability among Connecticut's utility companies by implementing a performance-based incentive system that ensures their earnings and profits are tied to good performance and certain penalties can be enacted amid extensive service disruptions. The bill came into being after public outcry about power company Eversource's poor response to customers after Tropical Storm Isaias earlier this year left 900,000 customers across the state without power. That's all from us for this edition. Do send us your questions and story ideas to the show via our website at connecticut-east.com or Facebook or Twitter at Connecticut East, where you can also listen to the show again on demand. And please like, follow, and share on your social media platforms too. I'm Brian Scott Smith. Thank you for listening.